Hi, I'm Sharon Silcox with the Triangle Radio Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. During the next 30 minutes, I'll be sharing nutrition information from both the Nutrition Action Health Letter and the Tufts Health and Nutrition Letter. Nutrition Action Health Letter is the flagship publication of the Center for Science in the Public Interest. Published 10 times a year, Nutrition Action provides honest, unbiased, science-based advice on nutrition and health. It's the world's largest circulation nutrition newsletter, bringing the latest nutrition news and advice to more than 500,000 readers. Nutrition Action is totally free of advertising, so we're free to blow the whistle on products that aren't what they pretend to be and to applaud the good ones. Please use the information presented in this broadcast in consultation with your personal physician. The following articles are from the January-February edition of the Nutrition Action Health Letter. The first article is titled Pound Wise, Six Things You May Not Know About Extra Weight, and it has been written by Bonnie Liebman. With 70% of American adults and 33% of children now classified as overweight or obese, the obesity epidemic is not exactly a secret. Yet, some recent findings about the causes and consequences of weight gain may surprise you. Number one, extra pounds means extra cancer risk. The evidence is extremely clear that excess weight increases the risk of cancer, says Walter Willett, professor of epidemiology at the Harvard T.H. Chan School of Public Health. I would give it a 90% plus certainty. Willett co-authored a recent report on obesity by the International Agency for Research on Cancer. Many people don't think about excess weight as a cause of cancer, notes Willett, but it's probably the second most important cause after smoking. That's largely because so many people are overweight and because extra pounds boosts the risk of so many cancers. For any one person, smoking is far more dangerous. It raises the risk of lung cancer 25-fold. Excess weight rarely more than doubles your risk of a dozen or so other cancers. How can excess body fat lead to cancer? Estrogen. The picture is clearest for some cancers of the breast in postmenopausal women and uterus, which are fueled by high levels of hormones like estrogen. Obese postmenopausal women have blood estrogen levels about 3 times higher than lean postmenopausal women, says Willett. Fat cells make estrogen. So it's no big surprise that women who are obese or even overweight have higher rates of cancer that are related to estrogen. Insulin. For pancreatic, kidney, and colorectal cancers, researchers are looking at another potential culprit. One likely mechanism is that excess weight often leads to higher blood insulin levels, explains Willett, and insulin basically makes cells multiply more rapidly. For breast cancer, both estrogen and insulin may matter. In one study, after researchers took estrogen into account, postmenopausal women with the highest blood insulin levels still had 2.5 times the risk of breast cancer of those with the lowest blood insulin levels. Inflammation. Excess weight can lead to chronic low-level inflammation that boosts the risk of cancers, like adenocarcinoma of the esophagus. Overweight is a cause of gastric reflux and heartburn, says Willett. The acidity causes cell destruction and inflammation, and that process increases the risk of cancer. People with obesity are 5 times more likely to get esophageal cancer, which has a dismal 18% 5-year survival rate, than those who are normal weight. The increase in adenocarcinoma of the esophagus is clearly related to the rise in obesity, says Willett. Number two, fat cells are hard to lose. What happens to the extra calories when you overindulge? To find out, researchers at the Mayo Clinic fed 23 lean young men and women 400 to 1,200 extra calories a day by padding their diets with Snicker bars, milkshakes, and Boost Plus drinks. After 2 months, the volunteers had gained about 8 pounds. But that surplus got stashed in different depots. Almost all the weight gain in abdominal body fat was an increase in fat cell size, says Michael Jensen, director of the Obesity Specialty Council at the Mayo Clinic. In contrast, when people gained leg fat, they actually gained new fat cells. Jensen's earlier study estimated that when people gained 3.5 pounds of new leg fat, they acquired roughly 2.6 billion new fat cells. Next, Jensen had the participants spend 2 more months cutting calories and upping their exercise. The result? 6 of the 8 pounds disappeared. Everybody lost all or pretty much all of the abdominal, subcutaneous, or visceral fat they had gained, says Jensen. The only fat that they hadn't yet lost was some of the leg fat they had gained. So we concluded that it's easier to shrink fat cells back down to their original size than to make fat cells go away. Are you stuck with those fat cells forever? We don't know whether the new fat cells would have eventually gone away if people had kept off the weight long enough, says Jensen. And don't assume that you'll never gain new fat cells around your middle. If you gain enough weight, you have to make new fat cells, says Jensen. From an average small fat cell to the biggest of the big, it's about a 4-fold increase in size. They can only get so big. Ironically, the leg fat that's hardest to lose is also the least harmful. Number 3. A big waist isn't good no matter what your weight. An oversized waist doesn't bode well, even if you're in the healthy weight range. If someone is keeping their weight about the same, but their waist is increasing, a very common pattern in middle-aged men, that can be a problem, says Willett. When researchers pooled data on roughly 650,000 men and women, the risk of dying over 9 years rose significantly for every additional 2 inches of waist, even in people who weren't overweight. If your abdominal circumference increases by more than 2 inches, that means you're out of balance, says Willett. A large waist matters in part because it's an unambiguous sign of extra fat. Our methods of measuring obesity are not perfect, notes Willett. We know that for the same height and weight, some people have more muscle while others have more fat. But if someone has a big belly, we know that it's not due to a big muscle sitting there. What's more, a larger waist could signal a bigger deposit of the visceral fat that's buried deep in the belly, which is more harmful than the subcutaneous fat that's just under your skin. Visceral fat accumulation is more closely linked to developing type 2 diabetes and coronary heart disease, says Ulf Reseras, associate professor of clinical nutrition and metabolism at Uppsala University in Sweden. Why? The main theory is that visceral fat cells release a lot of fat, which goes directly to the liver, where it causes metabolic disorders, says Reseras. Visceral fat may also release more inflammatory proteins than subcutaneous fat. Visceral fat is linked to insulin resistance, both in the liver and in other parts of the body, says Reseras. When you have insulin resistance, your insulin becomes less able to move blood sugar into cells. That often leads to type 2 diabetes. And a fatty liver produces more triglycerides, adds Reseras, which can increase the risk of cardiovascular disease in the long term. What do you gain? When do you gain visceral fat? When your subcutaneous fat can't cope. When people start gaining unhealthy amounts of subcutaneous fat, the fallback is to start putting any more fat into visceral fat cells, says the Mayo Clinic's Michael Jensen. How much is too much? It varies. Some people can gain a lot of subcutaneous fat, and it functions perfectly normally, says Jensen. And other people gain maybe just 4 or 5 pounds, and all of a sudden, it's completely dysfunctional. Worse yet, if the visceral fat cells reach their limit, any more fat gets stashed in muscle, the liver, and elsewhere. Those organs can't package the fat very well, so it can interfere with cell functions, says Jensen. What you eat may also matter. Number four, saturated fats may boost deep belly fat. Are some fats in foods more likely to end up as harmful visceral fat than as less harmful subcutaneous fat? To find out, Raceris and his colleagues devised what some have called the muffin study. We had lean people eat, on average, 3 muffins per day on top of their usual diet, he explains. That meant that each participant ate 750 more calories a day than he or she needed. We wanted a moderate, not an extreme, increase in calorie intake to represent the normal situation in the Western world, where most people gain weight after their 30s, explains Raceris. Half of the participants got muffins made with a saturated fat, palm oil, while the other half got muffins made with a polyunsaturated fat, sunflower oil. After 7 weeks, both groups had gained about the same amount of weight, about 3.5 pounds, but there was a difference. The subjects who consumed the muffins baked with saturated fat gained more visceral fat and more liver fat, says Raceris, whereas there was clearly less visceral fat accumulation in the individuals who consumed the muffins baked with unsaturated fat. Indeed, those people gained more lean tissue. In his recent but not yet published study, overweight or obese people gained liver fat when they ate muffins made with saturated but not unsaturated fat. So it's clear that that was not a chance finding, says Raceris. What about monounsaturated fats like olive or canola oil? The evidence is not yet as strong as it is for polyunsaturates, says Raceris. But some studies suggest that monounsaturated fat is better than saturated. Polyunsaturated omega-3 fats from fatty fish also seem good, though the evidence isn't as clear, adds Raceris. His bottom line? Replace some saturated fats from palm oil and butter, for instance, with a variety of mono- and polyunsaturated fats, mainly from plant sources like canola, olive, sunflower, and soybean oils, and from fish. And needless to say, don't overeat. If you gain weight, it's difficult to limit fat accumulation, says Raceris. Number five, sugars may boost liver and deep belly fat. Excess liver fat is a sign of trouble. It's associated with an increased risk for insulin resistance, type 2 diabetes, and liver damage, says Kimber Stanhope, a researcher at the University of California, Davis. Some researchers argue that a fatty liver also triggers insulin resistance, which can lead to diabetes. We still don't know if increased liver fat is the cause or the result of insulin resistance, says Stanhope. But even if a fatty liver doesn't lead to diabetes, it can cause damage. Over the long term, it can lead to non-alcoholic fatty liver disease and inflammation, says Stanhope. The prevalence of fatty liver is going up in both adults and children, she adds. Until recently, kids with fatty livers were rare. Clearly, the obesity epidemic deserves much of the blame. But in 2012, Danish scientists added a new wrinkle to the story. They reported that overweight or obese people who were told to drink a liter of a day of sugar-sweetened cola accumulated more liver and visceral fat after 6 months than those told to drink a liter a day of milk, which had the same number of calories, diet cola, or water. The fructose that made up roughly half of both table sugar and high fructose corn syrup may be the culprit. In a small recent study, men who were given 25% of their calories from fructose had more liver fat after 9 days than when they got 25% of their calories from starches like bread, cereal, pasta, rice, and potatoes, says Stanhope. We need more studies to be sure, but it appears likely that sugars increase liver fat. Number six, even an extra 5 to 20 pounds matters. Many misleading stories based on deeply flawed analyses have suggested that it's okay to put on some pounds during midlife, says Harvard's Walter Willett, but it's not a good idea at all. Willett co-authored a study that tracked roughly 93,000 women and 25,000 men from midlife to their later years. even modest increases in weight between entering adulthood and age 55 were related to a higher risk of the many outcomes we looked at, he notes. Women who gained only 5 to 20 pounds after age 18 had a higher risk of type 2 diabetes, cardiovascular disease, high blood pressure, obesity-related cancers, gallstones, and severe arthritis compared to women whose weight was stable. Men had to gain more weight before their risk of most problems rose, but those who gained just 5 to 20 pounds after age 21 had a higher risk of type 2 diabetes and high blood pressure. That's not trivial. The gain in weight may not show up as health problems by age 45 or 55, says Willett, but it's a strong predictor of how healthy you'll be from that time on. He cautions that you can gain weight and still have a body mass index classified as healthy. Women can go from, say, a BMI of 18 to a BMI of 24, and they're still technically at a healthy weight, explains Willett, but that corresponds roughly to a 40-pound weight gain. That represents a huge increase in risk. The goal? Stay as close as you can to what you weighed around age 20. If you see your weight from age 20 creeping up even by 5 pounds or so, that's something to be concerned about, says Willett. It's not just because those few pounds add some risk. More importantly, that weight gain essentially indicates that you're on track to gain even more weight, notes Willett. If you don't do something, that increase is going to continue, and by the time you get to 50 or 55, you can end up with a very large and very serious gain in weight. Even doctors may not take a small weight gain seriously. This has been a neglected issue, says Willett. Physicians often watch their patients gain weight and do nothing about it. Our study should be a heads up, both to health care providers and to everybody else. And this article includes an informational box titled Plain Defense. It's easy to put on pounds living in our environment where there's food all around and often no good place to exercise, says Harvard's Walter Willett. But that doesn't mean we shouldn't try the best we can to minimize that weight gain. Both quantity and quality matter. A high-quality diet with fruits, vegetables, beans, whole grains, and nuts can make it easier to control weight rather than loading up on things like sugar-sweetened beverages, refined starches, and sugar, says Willett. Exercise also matters. Your best bet? A mix of aerobics like walking, biking, jogging, or swimming, and strength resistance training. A weight loss diet with exercise shrinks visceral fat more than diet alone. Resistance training should be part of your activity pattern, says Willett. Even a few minutes, a few times a week, makes a big difference. That's because our muscles shrink as we age. Even if we keep our diet and activity the same, our muscle mass tends to go down due to decreases in hormones that maintain muscle, Willett explains. Testosterone, estrogen, and insulin-like growth factor decline with age for reasons we don't understand. Declining hormones is probably a good thing, he adds. If they didn't, we would probably have a lot more cancer. But the decline also means that our muscles shrink, so we need to increase resistance training just to maintain the same muscle mass. Don't like the gym? You don't need one. You can use elastic resistance bands, suggests Willett. It's just like lifting weights. You can exercise different muscle groups, and the bands cost about $3 each. The best part? You don't need to do it every single day. You don't need expensive equipment. You can do it at home. Sounds like you're out of excuses. Our next article is from the March edition of the Tufts Health and Nutrition Letter. Tufts University Health and Nutrition Letter is a lifestyle guide to achieving better health. It is written with your needs in mind, but is not a substitute for consulting with your physician or other health care providers. This article is titled Weight Loss, No Quick Fixes. Crash diets for rapid weight loss don't succeed in the long run. Achieving and maintaining an optimal body weight can be a challenge. For those of us who carry extra pounds that we want or need to shed, it's tempting to turn to crash dieting in hopes of rapid weight loss. Crash dieting takes many forms. It could be long periods of fasting, Or it could mean going on an extremely restricted liquid diet of soup or juice to cut your calorie intake to around 800 calories per day. It is possible to lose significant weight fairly rapidly by restricting calories to this degree, but only if medically supervised and with carefully formulated meals of concern or issues related to sustaining the weight loss. To lose weight successfully and sustainably, it's important to understand the physiology and psychology of weight loss. Without being informed and having a realistic strategy, your chances of long-term success are limited. For some basic insights and advice, we turn to Sai Das, PhD, a scientist in Tufts HNRCA Energy Metabolism Laboratory. Crash dieting sets you up for disappointment. That quick fix is neither effective nor sustainable for long-term weight maintenance and optimal body composition, Das says. You don't really invest in learning new habits or in unlearning the eating habits that you have ingrained in yourself over a long period of time. Diet quality counts. You do need to reduce calories to lose weight, but just eating fewer calories from low-quality foods is not a good long-term strategy. You need to adopt a healthy overall eating pattern, says Das. When you have a good dieting approach that is done in a nicely balanced way with the calories you need as well as good nutrition, you will lose weight without compromising body metabolism or composition. To improve the quality of your diet, increase fruits, vegetables, nuts, beans, yogurt, and fish, and avoid soda, processed meats, and foods rich in starch and sugar. The goal is to lose fat, not muscle. Dieting needs to be done in such a way in which you can maximize the benefit to get the best bang for your dieting buck, if you will, by losing fat, Das says. It's not just losing weight, and you want to do that with minimal loss of lean muscle mass, a metabolically active calorie burner. The key is coupling reduced calorie intake with physical activity. Metabolic shifts can derail weight loss. Research has shown that the body adapts to rapid weight loss by switching into a new mode called metabolic adaptation. Metabolism becomes more efficient, which helps the body survive longer by using less energy to maintain body functions, Das says. The body consumes less energy than you would normally need, which means that you have to reduce your calorie intake further in order to sustain the same rate of weight loss. Workouts won't work on their own. Some people try to use frequent and vigorous workouts at the gym or other forms of exercise to help them lose weight. Regular exercise is always good for your overall health, but most people can't rely on it to lose significant amounts of weight. One reason is that it's hard for many people to burn enough calories with exercise to lose weight. And you might end up compensating later in the day for those burnt exercise calories. The net calorie deficit may be insufficient for weight loss, Das says. Exercise helps maintain a healthy weight. Once you reach your weight goal, exercise can play an important role. Once you've lost the weight and the body is beginning to fight back, regular exercise helps you maintain the lost weight, Das says. One reason is that exercise can help you build and maintain muscle. Muscle burns more energy at rest and when one is physically active, Das says. As a result, any time you do work in the form of activity or movement, you're going to be burning more energy. Have strategies to control appetite. Powerful hormonal and psychological processes often trigger strong feelings of hunger and craving as you diet. Unfortunately, every time you succumb to those urges, it reinforces the negative behavior pattern. To increase your chances of success, have some strategies in place. And there's a little box accompanying this article on those strategies. Take charge. Successful dieting requires preemptive strategies to curb hunger and conquer cravings. Plan and prepare your meals several days in advance to help prevent poor last-minute choices. Eat meals and snacks at the same time every day. Include satiating fiber and protein in your meals. This helps tide you over to your next meal. Use spices and herbs liberally to help you attain a feeling of satisfaction with smaller portions. Eat meals mindfully and slowly to savor the taste. Remove foods from your home that trigger cravings. Have healthier substitute foods available, like raw veggies to cut up and ready to snack on, or a bowl of fruit, or a bowl of fruit on the kitchen counter. Develop ways to reduce anxiety and other emotional eating triggers. For example, meditate, take a hot shower, go for a walk, or listen to music. Shift your attention away from hunger and cravings with activities that require focused attention, such as playing solitaire, hobbies, cleaning yard work, or gardening. And now we have time for one or two news bites. Leafy greens protect aging brains. Older adults who ate 1 to 2 daily servings of leafy green vegetables showed less age-related decline in memory and other mental skills than those eating less, according to a study in neurology. Serving sizes for the study were 1 cup of raw salad greens or 1/2 cup of cooked spinach, kale, collards, or other greens. The study included 960 people ages 58 to 99. Over 5 years, researchers tested participants' memory and thinking skills using cognitive tests and used a questionnaire to measure their intake of leafy greens. As measured by the cognitive tests, participants who consumed the most servings were 11 years younger in their mental health. Compared with those who rarely or never ate leafy greens. The study is observational, so it doesn't prove that eating leafy greens directly slows brain aging, but it contributes to ongoing research to identify plant foods that may protect the aging brain as part of an overall healthy dietary pattern. Almonds and chocolate's good for cholesterol. Eating almonds or almonds and dark chocolate together, but not dark chocolate alone, improves blood cholesterol, says a study in the Journal of the American Heart Association. 31 overweight or obese participants aged 30 to 70 consumed 4 test diets for 4 weeks each in random order. Each of the test diets included take-home meals consistent with an average American diet, with one serving as a control and the other 3 being enhanced with almonds, dark chocolate and cocoa powder, or the combination of almonds and dark chocolate cocoa powder. The nuts and chocolate cocoa replaced butter, cheese, and refined grains in the control diet. Compared with the control diet, the overall cholesterol profile, such as total and bad LDL cholesterol or the number of LDL particles, improved modestly on both the almond-enhanced diet and the almond-plus dark chocolate cocoa powder diet. No significant differences in cholesterol levels were seen for dark chocolate cocoa powder alone compared with control. We've run out of time for today's episode of Nutrition News. Be sure to listen next time. I'm Sharon Silcox for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. This broadcast is readily available as a podcast after the broadcast at our website at triangleReadingService.org. So long until next time. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. That's 919-832-5138.